The Diamond as Big as the Ritz by F. Scott Fitzgerald. John T. Unger came from a family that had been well known in Hades, a small town on the Mississippi River, for several generations. And young John T. Unger, who had just turned 16, had danced all the latest dances from New York before he put on long trousers. And now, for a certain time, he was to be away from home. Nothing would suit his parents but that he should go to St. Midas's School near Boston. Hades was too small to hold their darling, gifted son. Mrs. Unger packed his trunks, and Mr. Unger presented John with a pocketbook stuffed with money. "Remember, you're always welcome here," he said. "You can be sure, boy, that we'll keep the home fires burning." "I know," answered John huskily. "Don't forget who you are and where you come from," said his father proudly. So the old man and the young shook hands, and John walked away with tears streaming from his eyes. He set his face resolutely towards his destination. St. Midas's school is half an hour from Boston in a Rolls-Pierce motor car. The actual distance will never be known, for no one, except John T. Unger, had ever arrived there save in a Rolls-Pierce, and probably no one ever will again. St. Midas's is the most expensive and the most exclusive boys' preparatory school in the world. In the middle of his second year at school, a quiet, handsome boy named Percy Washington had been put in John's class. The newcomer was pleasant in his manner, but for some reason he kept aloof from the other boys. The only person with whom he was intimate was John T. Unger. He invited him to spend the summer at his home in the West. It was only when they were in the train that Percy became, for the first time, rather communicative. "My father," he said, "is by far the richest man in the world." "Oh?" said John politely. He could think of no answer to make to this confidence. "By far the richest," repeated Percy. "I was reading in the World Almanac," began John, "that there was one man in America with an income of over $5 million a year, and four men with incomes of over $3 million a year, and..." "Oh, they're nothing." Percy's mouth was a half-moon of scorn. "My father could buy them out and not know he'd done it." "He must be very rich," said John. "I visited the Schlenitzer Murphys last Easter. Vivian Schlenitzer Murphy had rubies as big as hen's eggs." "I love jewels," agreed Percy enthusiastically. "And diamonds," said John eagerly. "The Schlenitzer Murphys had diamonds as big as walnuts." "That's nothing." Percy had leaned forward and dropped his voice to a low whisper. "That's nothing at all. My father has a diamond bigger than the Ritz-Carlton Hotel." The Montana sunset lay between two mountains like a gigantic bruise from which dark arteries spread themselves over a poison sky. An immense distance under the sky crouched the village of Fish, minute, dismal, and forgotten. Six times or so a year, the Transcontinental Express, through some inconceivable jurisdiction, stopped at the village of Fish. And when this occurred, a figure or so would disembark and drive off toward the bruised sunset. On this night, at 7:02, Percy Washington and John T. Unger disembarked. An opaque body stood somewhere in the gloom. It turned upon them a luminous disk, which regarded them like a malignant eye out of the unfathomable night. John saw that it was the taillight of an immense automobile, larger and more magnificent than any he had ever seen. Two black servants, dressed in glittering livery, such as one sees in pictures of royal processions in London, were standing at attention beside the car. "Get in," said Percy to his friend, as their trunks were tossed to the ebony roof of the limousine. "Gosh, what a car!" John saw that the upholstery consisted of 1,000 minute and exquisite tapestries of silk, woven with jewels and embroideries, and set upon a background of cloth of gold. "What a car!" cried John again in amazement. "This thing?" Percy laughed. "Why, it's just an old junk we use for a station wagon." They had now entered the break between the two mountains, and almost immediately the way became much rougher. Within a few minutes, crossing a high rise, they caught a glimpse of a pale moon, newly risen in the distance. The car stopped suddenly, and several figures took shape out of the dark beside it. They were also black men, and they set to work. Four immense cables dangling from overhead were attached with hooks to the hubs of the great jeweled wheels. At a resounding, "Hey-ya!" John felt the car being lifted slowly from the ground, up and up, clear of the tallest rocks on both sides, then higher, until he could see a wavy, moonlit valley stretched out before him in sharp contrast to the quagmire of rocks that they had just left. In a moment, they were going down again, and finally, with a soft bump, they were landed upon the smooth earth. "The worst is over," said Percy, squinting out of the window. "This is where the United States ends, Father says." "Are we in Canada?" "We are not. We're in the middle of the Montana Rockies, but you are now on the only 5 square miles of land in the country that's never been surveyed." "Why hasn't it? Did they forget it?" "No," said Percy, grinning. "My father fixed it so that their compasses were in the strongest magnetic field ever artificially set up. He had a whole set of surveying instruments made with a slight defection that would allow for this territory not to appear, and he substituted them for the ones that were to be used. Then he had a river deflected, and he had what looked like a village built up on its banks, so that they'd see it and think it was a town 10 miles farther up the valley. There's only one thing my father's afraid of," he concluded. "Only one thing in the world that could be used to find us out."
"What's that?"
Percy sank his voice to a whisper. "Aeroplanes," he breathed. "We've got 6 anti-aircraft guns, and we've arranged it so far. But there have been a few deaths, and a great many prisoners. Not that we mind that, you know, Father and I. But it upsets Mother and the girls. John shook his head, and the wraith of a hollow laugh issued silently from his parted lips. What desperate transaction lay hidden here? What terrible and golden mystery. The chinchilla clouds had drifted past now, and outside the Montana night was bright as day. The tapestry brick of the road was smooth to the tread of the great tires as they rounded a still moonlit lake. Then they came out into a broad avenue of lawn, and John's exclamation of pleasure was simultaneous with Percy's taciturn, "We're home." Full in the light of the stars, an exquisite chateau rose from the borders of the lake, then melted in grace, in translucent feminine languor. Into the massed darkness of a forest of pine, the many towers, the slender tracery of the sloping parapets, the shattered softness of the intersecting planes of starshine and blue shade, all trembled on John's spirit like a chord of music. Then in a moment the car stopped before wide, high marble steps, around which the night air was fragrant with a host of flowers. Two great doors swung silently open, and amber light flooded out upon the darkness, silhouetting the figure of an exquisite lady with black, high-piled hair, who held out her arms toward them. "Mother," Percy was saying, "this is my friend, John Unger, from Hades." Afterward, John remembered that first night as a daze of many colors, of music soft as a voice in love, and of the beauty of things, lights and shadows, and motions and faces. There was a white-haired man who stood drinking a many-hued cordial from a crystal thimble set on a golden stem. There was a room where the solid, soft gold of the walls yielded to the pressure of his hand, and a room that was like a platonic conception of the ultimate prison, ceiling, floor, and all. It was lined with an unbroken mass of diamonds. Diamonds of every size and shape. It dazzled the eyes with a whiteness that could be compared only with itself, beyond human wish or dream. Then they were at dinner, where each plate was of two almost imperceptible layers of solid diamond. John tried drowsily to answer a question that had been asked him, but the honeyed luxury that clasped his body added to the illusion of sleep. Then, without a movement, without resistance, he seemed to float off and away. When he awoke, he knew that several hours had passed. He was in a great, quiet room with ebony walls, and his young host was standing over him. "You fell asleep at dinner," Percy was saying. "Servants undressed and bathed you while you were sleeping." "Is this a bed or a cloud?" sighed John. "Percy, before you go, I want to apologize."
"For what?"
"For doubting you when you said you had a diamond As big as the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Percy smiled. It's the mountain the chateau rests on. It's not very big for a mountain. But except about 50 feet of sod and gravel on top, it's solid diamond. One diamond. 1 cubic mile without a flaw. Aren't you listening? But John T. Unger had again fallen asleep. Morning. As he awoke, he perceived drowsily that the room had become dense with sunlight. The ebony panels of one wall had slid aside, leaving his chamber half open to the day. A large black servant in a white uniform stood beside his bed. Good evening, muttered John, summoning his brains from the wild places.
Good morning, sir. Are you ready for your bath, sir? Oh, don't get up. I'll put you in. If you'll just unbutton your pajamas. There. Thank you, sir.
John lay quietly as his pajamas were removed. He felt the bed tilt up slowly on its side. He began to roll, and sliding down a fleecy incline, he plumped gently into water, the same temperature as his body. Gazing through the crystal surface on which he sat, he could see fish gliding past his outstretched toes, which were separated from them only by the thickness of the crystal.
I suppose, sir, that you'd like hot rose water and soap suds this morning, sir? And perhaps cool salt water to finish?
The black man was standing beside him. Yes, agreed John, smiling inanely. As you please. The black man pressed a button, and a warm rain began to fall from a fountain arrangement nearby. The water turned to a pale rose color, and jets of liquid soap spurted into it from the corners of the bath. In a moment, a dozen little paddle wheels had churned the mixture into a radiant rainbow of pink foam, which enveloped him softly with its delicious lightness. He was listening intently to the sound of flutes from just outside, flutes dripping a melody that was like a waterfall, cool and green as the room itself. Then he got dressed and walked out into the brisk sunshine of his living room, where he found breakfast waiting for him, and Percy, gorgeous in white kid knickerbockers, smoking in an easy chair. This is a story of the Washington family, as Percy sketched it for John during breakfast. The father of the present Mr. Washington had been a Virginian, Fitznorman Culpepper Washington. At the close of the Civil War, he was a 25-year-old colonel with a played-out plantation and about $1,000 in gold. The young colonel decided to present the Virginia estate to his younger brother and go west. He selected 24 of the most faithful ex-slaves and bought 25 tickets to the west, where he intended to start a sheep and cattle ranch. When he had been in Montana for less than a month, he stumbled on his great discovery. He noticed that a squirrel was carrying something shiny in its mouth. Just before it vanished into its hole, it dropped its burden. Fitznorman's eye was caught by a gleam in the grass beside him. In 10 seconds, he had completely lost his appetite and gained $100,000. The squirrel had made him a present of a large and perfect diamond. 12 hours later, he was digging furiously at the side of the mountain, but he found himself in a quandary. The mountain was a diamond. It was literally nothing else but solid diamond. He filled his saddlebags full of glittering samples, and in New York managed to dispose of half a dozen small stones for about $200,000 in gold. Wild rumors became current that a diamond mine had been discovered on the Jersey coast, on Long Island, beneath Washington Square. Excursion trains, packed with men carrying picks and shovels, began to leave New York hourly. But by that time, young Fitznorman was on his way back to Montana. The diamond in the mountain was approximately equal in quantity to all the rest of the diamonds known to exist in the world. There was no valuing it by any regular computation, however, for it was one solid diamond. And if it were offered for sale, the bottom would fall out of the market. He was the richest man that ever lived. And yet, was he worth anything at all? There was no telling to what measures the government might resort. They might take over the claim immediately and institute a monopoly. There was no alternative. He must market his mountain in secret. He sent south for his younger brother and put him in charge of his ex-slaves, blacks who had never realized that slavery was abolished. Fitznorman set out for foreign parts with $100,000 and 2 trunks filled with rough diamonds. He sailed for Russia in a Chinese junk, and in St. Petersburg took obscure lodgings and called immediately upon the court jeweler, announcing that he had a diamond for the Tsar. On his promise to return in a year with larger and finer stones, he was allowed to leave for India. The court treasurers deposited to his credit in American banks the sum of $15 million under 4 different aliases. He returned to America after 2 years. He had visited the capitals of 22 countries and talked with 5 emperors, 11 kings, 3 princes, a shah, a khan, and a sultan. At that time, Fitznorman estimated his own wealth at $1 billion. The history of Fitznorman Washington was a long epic in gold. He married a Virginia lady by whom he had a single son, and he was compelled, due to a series of unfortunate complications, to murder his brother, whose unfortunate habit of drinking himself into an indiscreet stupor had several times endangered their safety. But very few other murders stained these happy years of progress and expansion. When Fitznorman had been dead 3 years, his son, Braddock, decided that the business had gone far enough. The wealth taken out of the mountain was beyond exact computation. Then he did a very simple thing. He sealed up the mine. What had been taken out of it would support all the Washingtons yet to be born in unparalleled luxury. His one care must be the protection of his secret. Lest in the possible panic attendant on its discovery, he should be reduced with all the property holders in the world to utter poverty. This was the family among whom John T. Unger was staying. This was the story he heard in his silver-walled living room the morning after his arrival. After breakfast, John found his way out the entrance and looked curiously at the scene before him. He descended the steps and struck off across a park toward a patch of moss under some trees. Then he saw a girl coming toward him over the grass. She was dressed in a little white gown, and her pink bare feet scattered the dew before them as she came. She was younger than John, not more than 16, and she was the most beautiful person he had ever seen.
"Hello," she cried softly. "I'm Kismin. You met my sister Jasmine last night."
"I hope you're better this morning," said John's voice.
"You darling," added his eyes.
"Are you from the east?" she asked.
"No," answered John. "I'm from Hades."
"I'm going east to school this fall," she said. "Do you think I'll like it?"
"Your father wants you to be proud," observed John.
"We are,"
she answered, her eyes shining with dignity.
"None of us has ever been punished. Father said we never should be. Once when my sister Jasmine was a little girl, she pushed him downstairs, and he just got up and limped away."
"Do you know," began John, "you're much more sophisticated than I thought you were."
"Oh, no," she exclaimed. "I think that sophisticated young people are terribly common. Don't you?"
"I didn't mean that. I only said it to tease you." "Because I wouldn't mind if I were," she persisted.
"But I'm not. I'm very innocent and girlish. I never smoke or drink or read anything except poetry."
Kismin smiled at him, and a stillborn tear tripped from the corner of one blue eye.
"I like you," she whispered. "Are you going to spend all your time with Percy? Or will you be nice to me? Just think, I'm absolutely fresh ground. I've never had a boy in love with me in all my life. I've never been allowed to see boys alone, except Percy. I came all the way out here into this grove, hoping to run into you, where the family wouldn't be around."
Deeply flattered, John bowed from the hips, as he had been taught at dancing school.
"We'd better go now," said Kismin sweetly. "I have to be with Mother at 11. You haven't asked me to kiss you once. I thought boys always did that nowadays."
John drew himself up proudly. "Some of them do," he answered, "but not me." Side by side, they walked back toward the house. John stood facing Mr. Braddock Washington in the full sunlight. The elder man was about 40, with a proud, vacuous face. In the morning, he smelt of horses. The best horses. He and Percy were showing John around.
The slaves' quarters are there.
His walking stick indicated a cloister of marble on their left that ran in graceful Gothic along the side of the mountain. In my youth, I was distracted for a while by a period of absurd idealism. During that time, they lived in luxury. I equipped every one of their rooms with a tile bath. They had orders to bathe every day. And if they hadn't, I might have ordered a sulfuric acid shampoo. I discontinued the baths because several of them caught cold and died. Water is not good for certain races, except as a beverage.
John decided to nod his head in sober agreement. Braddock Washington made him uncomfortable.
All these slaves are descendants of the ones my father brought north with him. There are about 250 now. This is the golf course, he continued, as they strolled along the velvet winter grass. It's all green, you see, no fairways, no rough, no hazards. He smiled pleasantly at John.
Many men in the cage, Father? Asked Percy suddenly.
Braddock Washington stumbled and let forth an involuntary curse.
One less than there should be, he ejaculated darkly. And then added after a moment, we've had difficulties.
Mother was telling me, exclaimed Percy, that Italian teacher...
A ghastly error, said Braddock Washington angrily. But of course there's a good chance that we may have got him. Then there's always the possibility that if he did get away, his story wouldn't be believed. Nevertheless, I've had 24 men looking for him in different towns around here.
And no luck?
Some. 14 of them reported to my agent that they'd each killed a man answering to that description. But, of course, it was probably only the reward they were after.
He broke off. They had come to a large cavity in the earth, about the circumference of a merry-go-round, and covered by a strong iron grating. John stepped to the edge and gazed. Immediately his ears were assailed by a wild clamor from below.
Come on down to hell! Hello, kiddo. How's the air up there? Hey, throw us a rope.
Mr. Washington put out his cane and touched a button in the grass, and the scene below sprang into light. These are some adventurous aviators who had the misfortune to discover El Dorado, he remarked.
Below them, there had appeared a large hollow in the earth, shaped like the interior of a bowl. The sides were steep and apparently of polished glass, and on its slightly concave surface stood about 24 men. Their upturned faces were covered by long growths of beard. Braddock Washington drew a garden chair to the edge of the pit and sat down.
Well, how are you, boys?
A chorus of execration in which all joined except a few, too dispirited to cry out, rose up into the sunny air,
But Braddock Washington heard it with unruffled composure. When its last echo had died away, he spoke again.
I've told you the situation. I don't want you here. I wish to heaven I'd never seen you. Your own curiosity got you here. And any time that you can think of a way out, which protects me and my interests, I'll be glad to consider it. But so long as you confine your efforts to digging tunnels, yes, I know about the new one you've started, you won't get very far.
A tall man moved apart from the others and held up his hand to call his captor's attention.
You pretend, he cried, to be a fair-minded man. How absurd. How could a man of my position be fair-minded toward you? You might as well speak of being fair-minded toward a piece of steak. I've offered to have all or any of you painlessly executed, if you wish. I've offered to have your wives, sweethearts, children, and mothers kidnapped and brought out here. I'll enlarge your place down there and feed and clothe you the rest of your lives. But that's as far as my ideas go.
How about trusting us not to peach on you?
Cried someone.
You don't proffer that suggestion seriously, said Washington, with an expression of scorn. I did take out one man to teach my daughter Italian. Last week he got away. Do you expect me to take chances with any of you after an experience like that?
Mr. Washington reached forward suddenly with his cane and pushed the button on the grass so that the picture below went out instantly. And there remained only that great dark mouth, covered dismally with the black teeth of the grating. John and Kismin were in love. Late one afternoon, when the Ruby and Ermine music room was quiet, he held her hand, and she gave him such a look that he whispered her name aloud.
Did you say Kismin? She asked softly. Or...
She had wanted to be sure. She thought she might have misunderstood. Neither of them had ever kissed before. But in the course of an hour, it seemed to make little difference. The afternoon drifted away. That night, when a last breath of music drifted down from the highest tower, they each lay awake, happily dreaming over the separate minutes of the day. They had decided to be married as soon as possible. Every day, Mr. Washington and the two young men went hunting or fishing in the deep forests, or played golf around the somnolent course, games which John diplomatically allowed his host to win. Mrs. Washington, aloof and reserved, was apparently indifferent to her two daughters, and entirely absorbed in her son, Percy. Jasmine, the elder daughter, resembled Kismin in appearance, except that she was utterly unlike her in temperament. Jasmine resembled Percy in that her chaste and consistent selfishness ran like a pattern through their every idea.
John was enchanted by the wonders of the chateau and the valley. Braddock Washington, so Percy told him, had caused to be kidnapped a landscape gardener, an architect, and a designer of stage settings. But one by one, they had shown their uselessness. They all went mad early one morning after spending the night in a single room trying to agree upon the location of a fountain, and were now confined comfortably in an insane asylum at Westport, Connecticut.
But,
inquired John curiously, who did plan all your wonderful reception rooms and halls and approaches and bathrooms?
Well, answered Percy, I blush to tell you, but it was a moving picture fellow. He was the only man we found who was used to playing with an unlimited amount of money. Though he did tuck his napkin in his collar and couldn't read or write.
One afternoon, late in August, a chance remark of Kissmean's changed the face of the entire situation and threw John into a state of terror. They were in their favorite grove, and between kisses, John was indulging in some romantic forebodings.
Sometimes I think we'll never marry, he said softly. You're too wealthy. No one as rich as you are can be like other girls. I should marry the daughter of some well-to-do wholesale hardware man from Omaha or Sioux City.
I knew the daughter of a wholesale hardware man once, remarked Kismet. I don't think you'd have been contented with her. She was a friend of my sister's. She visited here.
Oh,
then you've had other guests, exclaimed John in surprise. Kissmean seemed to regret her words.
Oh, yes, she said hurriedly. We've had a few.
To his great surprise, Kissmean began to weep.
I grew quite attached to some of them. So did Jasmine. But she kept inviting them anyway. I couldn't understand it.
Stunned with horror, John sat there open-mouthed, feeling the nerves of his body twitter like so many sparrows perched upon his spinal column.
Do you mean to say that your father had them murdered before they left?
She nodded.
In August, usually, or early in September. It's only natural for us to get all the pleasure out of them that we can first.
It was done very nicely. They were drugged while they were asleep, and their families were always told that they died of scarlet fever in Butte.
And so, cried John accusingly, you were letting me make love to you, and pretending to return it, and talking about marriage, all the time, knowing perfectly well that I'd never get out of here alive.
Well, I thought your last days might as well be pleasant for both of us. But then I fell in love with you. And I'm honestly sorry you're going to be put down. Though I'd rather you'd be put away than ever kiss another girl.
John's voice trembled with anger.
If you haven't any more pride and decency. Going to have an affair with a fellow that you know isn't much better than a corpse.
The rose bushes were parted, displaying Braddock Washington.
Who kissed a corpse?
He demanded in obvious disapproval.
Nobody, answered Kismeen. We were just joking.
What are you two doing here, anyhow? He demanded gruffly. Kismeen, you ought to be... reading or playing golf with your sister. Go, read. Go, play golf.
Then he bowed at John and went up the path.
See, said Kismeen crossly, you've spoiled it all. He'd have you poisoned if he thought we were in love.
We're not, cried John fiercely. Inside of 6 hours, I'll be over those mountains, if I have to gnaw a passage through them.
They had both got to their feet, and at this remark, Kismeen came close and put her arms through his.
I'm going too.
You must be crazy.
Of course I'm going.
Very well, dearest, he agreed, with pale and unconvincing affection. We'll go together. Long after midnight, John's body gave a nervous jerk, and he sat suddenly upright. He had heard a faint, faraway sound that died upon a bed of wind, clouded with uneasy dreams. But the sharp noise was the click of a turned knob. Then he saw a vague figure standing by the door. With a sudden movement, John pressed the button by his bedside and was sitting in the green, sunken bath of the adjoining room, waked into alertness by the shock of the cold water which half filled it. He sprang out. The door opened noiselessly. For a moment, John hesitated. Then, simultaneously, two things happened. The door of his own sitting room swung open, precipitating 3 naked slaves into the hall. And as John swayed in wild terror toward the stairway, another door slid back in the wall on the other side of the corridor, and John saw Braddock Washington standing in the lighted lift. On the instant, the 3 black slaves, John had never seen any of them before, and it flashed through his mind that they must be the professional executioners, paused in their movement toward John and turned expectantly to the man in the lift, who burst out with an imperious command. Get in here, all 3 of you, quick as hell! The 3 executioners darted into the cage. The oblong of light was blotted out as the lift door slid shut, and John was again alone in the hall. Had the slaves risen in revolt? Had the aviators forced aside the iron bars of the grating? It was probable that Percy was hurrying to his father's assistance, and it occurred to John that this was his opportunity to plan an immediate escape. Shivering a little in his wet pajamas, he returned to his room, dressed himself quickly, then mounted a long flight of stairs and turned down the corridor, carpeted with Russian sable, which led to Kismeen's suite. Kismeen stood near the window in a listening attitude, and as John entered, she turned toward him.
Oh, it's you,
she whispered, crossing the room to him.
Did you hear them?
I heard your father's slaves in my...
No, she interrupted excitedly. Aeroplanes. I saw one a few moments ago,
dead against the moon. We're going to open on them right away.
Are they here on purpose?
Yes. It's that Italian who got away.
A succession of sharp cracks tumbled in through the open window. Kismine uttered a little cry, took a penny with fumbling fingers from a box in her dresser, and ran to one of the electric lights. In an instant, the entire chateau was in darkness. She had blown out the fuse.
"Come on," she cried to him. "We'll go up to the roof garden and watch it from there."
It was only a step to the tower lift, and as she pressed the button that shot them upward, he put his arms around her in the darkness and kissed her mouth. A minute later, they had stepped out upon the star-white platform. Above, under the misty moon, floated a dozen dark-winged bodies in a constant, circling course. From here and there in the valley, flashes of fire leaped toward them, followed by sharp detonations. Then, as the aeroplanes began to release their bombs, the whole of the valley became a panorama of deep, reverberate sound and lurid light. Suddenly, the whole portico of the blacks' quarters cracked asunder. A geyser of flame shot up from under the colonnades, and great fragments of jagged marble were hurled as far as the borders of the lake.
"There go $50,000 worth of slaves," cried Kismine, "at pre-war prices. So few Americans have any respect for property."
The aim of the aeroplanes was becoming more precise minute by minute, and only two of the anti-aircraft guns were still retaliating. It was obvious that the garrison, encircled with fire, could not hold out much longer.
"Come on," cried John, pulling Kismine's arm. "We've got to go."
"We'll have to wake Jasmine," she said, as they hurried toward the lift. Then she added, in a sort of childish delight, "We'll be poor, won't we? Like people in books. And I'll be an orphan. And utterly free. Free and poor. What fun."
"It's impossible to be both together," said John grimly. "As an extra caution, you'd better dump the contents of your jewel box into your pockets." 10 minutes later, the two girls met John in the dark corridor, and they descended to the main floor of the chateau. Passing for the last time through the magnificence of the splendid halls, they stood for a moment out on the terrace, watching the burning slave quarters and the flaming embers of two planes which had fallen on the other side of the lake. John and the two sisters passed down the marble steps, turned sharply to the left, and began to ascend a narrow path that wound like a garter about the Diamond Mountain. Kismine knew a heavily wooded spot halfway up where they could make an escape along a secret path laid in a rocky gully.
It was 3 o'clock when they attained their destination. The obliging and phlegmatic Jasmine fell off to sleep immediately. Shortly after 4 o'clock, the last remaining gun went out of action in a swift tongue of red smoke. When the planes had made certain that the beleaguered possessed no further resources, they would land, and the dark and glittering reign of the Washingtons would be over. The valley grew quiet. The embers of the two aeroplanes glowed like the eyes of some monster
crouched in the grass. The chateau stood dark and silent, beautiful without light, as it had been beautiful in the sun. Then John perceived that Kismine, like her sister, had fallen sound asleep. It was long after 4 when he became aware of footsteps along the path they had lately followed, and he waited in breathless silence. When the steps had gone a safe distance up the mountain, he followed. Halfway to the steep summit, he slowed down his pace, warned by an animal sense that there was life just ahead of him. Coming to a high boulder, he lifted his head gradually above the edge. Braddock Washington was standing there, motionless. He remained for a few moments absorbed in some inscrutable contemplation. Then he signaled to the 2 slaves who had crouched at his feet to lift the burden which lay between them. As they struggled upright, the first yellow beam of the sun struck through the innumerable prisms of an immense and exquisitely chiseled diamond. And a white radiance was kindled that glowed upon the air like a fragment of the morning star. Braddock Washington lifted his head and slowly raised his arms in a gesture of attention, as one who would call a great crowd to hear. But there was no crowd, only the vast silence of the mountain and the sky.
"You out there?" he cried. "You there?"
He paused, his arm still uplifted, his head held attentively, as though he were expecting an answer. But the mountain was bare of human life. There was only sky and a mocking flute of wind along the treetops.
"Oh, you above there!"
The voice was becoming strong and confident.
"You there!"
Words, too quickly uttered to be understood, flowing one into the other. John listened breathlessly, catching a phrase here and there. Braddock Washington was offering a bribe to God. The diamond in the arms of his slaves was some advance sample, a promise of more to follow. For a while, his discourse took the form of reminding God of this gift or that which divinity had deigned to accept from men, great churches, if he would rescue cities from the plague. Gifts of gold, of human lives, and beautiful women, and captive armies, of children and queens, of beasts of the forest and field, sheep and goats, harvests and cities, whole conquered lands that had been offered up in lust or blood for his appeasal. And now he, Braddock Washington, Emperor of Diamonds, would give to God the greatest diamond in the world, set in a great dome of beaten gold. And on this altar there would be slain, for the amusement of the divine benefactor, any victim he should choose. In return, he asked only a simple thing. A thing that for God would be absurdly easy. Only that matters should be as they were yesterday, at this hour, and that they should so remain. So very simple. Left but the heavens open, swallowing these men and their aeroplanes, and then close again. Let him have his slaves once more, restored to life and well. God had his price, of course. He must have his price. And the price would be rare. No cathedral whose building consumed many years. No pyramid constructed by 10,000 workmen would be like this cathedral, this pyramid. He paused there. That was his proposition. Providence could take it or leave it. He lifted his head high to the heavens, like a prophet of old, magnificently mad. Then, as John stared in giddy fascination, it seemed to him that a curious phenomenon took place somewhere around him. It was as though the sky had darkened for an instant. The bird's song ceased. The trees were still. And far over the mountain, there was a mutter of dull, menacing thunder. That was all. The wind died along the tall grasses of the valley, and the risen sun sent hot waves of yellow mist that made its path bright before it. The leaves laughed in the sun, and their laughter shook the trees. God had refused the bribe. For another moment, John watched the triumph of the day. Then, turning, he saw a bright flutter down by the lake, then another flutter, then another, like the dance of golden angels alighting from the clouds. The aeroplanes had come to earth. John ran down to where the two girls were awake and waiting for him. Kismine sprang to her feet, the jewels in her pockets jingling, a question on her parted lips. But instinct told John that there was no time for words. They must get off the mountain without losing a moment. Clear against the sky, a broken, white-haired man was slowly descending the steep slope, followed by two gigantic black men who carried a burden between them, which still flashed and glittered in the sun. Halfway down, two other figures joined them. John could see that they were Mrs. Washington and her son. The Negro stooped and pulled up what appeared to be a trap door in the side of the mountain. Into this, they all disappeared. The white-haired man first, then his wife and son, finally the two slaves, the glittering tips of whose jeweled headdresses caught the sun for a moment before the trapdoor descended and engulfed them all. Kismine clutched Sean's arm.
"Oh!" she cried wildly. "Where are they going? What are they going to do?"
"It must be some underground way of escape." A little scream from the two girls interrupted his sentence.
"Don't you see?"
sobbed Kismine hysterically.
The mountain is wired. Even as she spoke, the whole surface of the mountain had changed suddenly to a dazzling, burning yellow, which showed up through the jacket of turf as a light shows through a human hand, and then, like an extinguished filament, it disappeared, revealing a black waste from which blue smoke arose slowly, carrying off with it what remained of vegetation and of human flesh. Simultaneously, and with an immense concussion, the chateau literally threw itself into the air, bursting into flaming fragments as a powdery dust of marble drifted from the great featureless pile that had once been the House of Jewels. There was no more sound, and the three people were alone in the valley. At sunset, John and his two companions reached the high cliff which had marked the boundaries of the Washington's dominion, and looking back found the valley tranquil and lovely in the dusk. They sat down to finish the food which Jasmine had brought with her in a basket.
"There,"
she said, as she spread the tablecloth and put the sandwiches in a neat pile upon it. "Don't they look tempting? I always think that food tastes better outdoors." With that remarked Kismin, Jasmine enters the middle class. "Now," said John eagerly, "turn out your pocket and let's see what jewels you brought along. If you made a good selection, we three ought to live comfortably all the rest of our lives." Obediently, Kismin put her hand in her pocket and tossed two handfuls of glittering stones before him.
"Not so bad," cried John enthusiastically. "They aren't very big, but..."
"Hello?" His expression changed as he held one of them up to the declining sun. "Why, these aren't diamonds. There's something the matter."
"By golly,"
exclaimed Kismin with a startled look.
"What an idiot I am."
"Why, these are rhinestones," cried John.
"I know,"
she broke into a laugh. "I opened the wrong drawer. They belonged on the dress of a girl who visited Jasmine. I got her to give them to me in exchange for diamonds. I'd never seen anything but precious stones before."
"And this is what you brought?" "I'm afraid so."
She fingered the brilliants wistfully.
"I think I like these better. I'm a little tired of diamonds."